Did I ever tell you about what happened to a woman who's the aunt of a guy who works with my brother? She drove her Mercedes into a crowded parking lot up at the Plaza del Lago, north of Chicago. She searched in vain for a parking space, and then she saw another car getting ready to leave, so she pulled up nearby and was waiting to get into that space. Just as the other car pulled out, a shiny blue sports car zips into the space. The young driver smiles as he gets out, and he shouts, "You've got to be young and fast." This older woman thought about that for a moment. Then she rammed the sports car. She backed up. She rammed it again and again. The young guy came running out in horror. "What are you doing?" he shouted. And the woman smiled and she said, "You've got to be old and rich." And then she drove away. That really happened to a woman who I know, rather is known by a friend of mine who works for my brother. At least that's the way urban legends go. I've just been reading from the newest book by Jan Harald Brunvand, The Mexican Pet, More New Urban Legends and Some Old Favorites, a fascinating area of folkloristic research. And we'll be talking, of course, with Jan Brunvand tonight, and we want to hear some of your legends, whether you know them to be legends or not, the tales that people tell because they happen to somebody I know or to the sister-in-law of my brother-in-law's best friend. Right on to our second seminar with Jan Harald Brunvand after the usual update on the evening's news from David Stewart.
From WGN Radio Chicago, it's time now for Extension 720. Here is your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And here's the man who knows all about what happened to the best friend of his brother-in-law's sister's cousin. That's usually the way, isn't it, Jan Brunvand, that we have these urban folk tales relayed to us?
Yeah, it's a foaf is what it is. That's spelled F-O-A-F, friend of a friend.
Friend of a friend.
Yeah, somebody knows somebody who thinks they know somebody that it happened to, and it never really happened is what I'm finding as I study these.
And these foafs have been around, I suppose, forever. These are, you call them urban legends or urban folk tales. They're urban because most of us live in cities now, but the same process has been going on
since
men first organized in society, I suppose.
Exactly. It's the same kind of transmission that, oral word-of-mouth transmission that ballads and superstitions and old folk songs and fairy tales used to circulate among the peasants and so on. But now it's city people shopping, going on vacation, using their microwave ovens, and so on, that are the subjects of these stories. And it's people in the workplace and at home and at parties who are telling them. So it's very much a vein of modern folklore.
Like that lady from San Diego who was doing some of her shopping down in Tijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the lead urban folk tale in your new book, The Mexican Pet. Tell the story.
Yeah.
What happened to that lady?
What happened to that lady was that she saw a little doggy, cute little doggy, came up to her table at an open-air restaurant.
Down there in Tijuana.
Yeah. And she fed it some scraps from the table and petted it, picked it up and cuddled it. And she tried to ask the waiter at the restaurant about this animal, and he just didn't understand her question or didn't have anything to say. And she decided to bring it back to the States, to put it in her purse and carry it home on the plane or in the back seat of the car or something.
She sort of smuggled it in.
First the snuggle and then the smuggle. I guess that's the way it went.
A snuggly smuggle.
Yeah, when this is told, there's a great deal of cuddling of that pet. And in fact, she's very careful of it because she takes it right to the vet for shots a couple days later. And the vet takes one look at it and says, "Lady, this is a long-haired Mexican sewer rat. And furthermore, I think it's diseased."
Yeah. There are lots of animal stories that circulate on these folk tale circuits. What are some other good ones that you picked up lately?
Well, in a lot of them, the animals don't come off very well. Let me tell you first a sort of classic one. The family that has picked some mushrooms in the woods, and they're not sure if they're poison or not. They're all the same kind of mushrooms, and they feed some to the cat. And the cat nibbles them up, and they seem okay. So they cook them up, and they're eating dinner. And somebody looks out the window and says, "Hey, the cat hasn't moved in a while. The cat is lying there on the lawn, motionless." And they right away assume the cat has died from eating poison mushrooms. And they rush to the hospital, have their stomachs pumped, and they come back feeling terrible. And then somebody sees a note on the back porch or something like that. And it turns out that the cat was hit by a car, the neighbor backed over it, or a delivery man or something, left a note apologizing for this. Or one way or another, they learned that the cat's death had nothing whatever to do with the mushrooms. So, you know, there are stories like that where it's almost like a family member, except that's a heck of a way to treat a family member, offering him the chance of eating poison mushrooms. On the other hand, there are stories where the animals win win even while losing, I could say. Guy is a brand new camper. He's out west, and he's kind of sadistic, and he's got hold of a jackrabbit, and alive, see, and he has some dynamite, and he ties or tapes the stick of dynamite to the little animal, lights it and lets it go, and the scared animal goes right under his brand new camper and blows it to smithereens.
Now, you've got about four or five variants of that story.
Yeah.
Republished in your new book, The Mexican Pet. So that's obviously a very popular one, and it gets adapted to suit local circumstance, and you work little variations on mm-hmm. it as it moves from the Ozarks to North Dakota, or as it moves from some country shire in England over to some town in Normandy or something mm-hmm. of the sort. This seems to be rather a universal story.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of references to that exploding animal story seem to suggest that it started in Australia, and I've talked to Australian people who said that's one of our stories and so on. But
where they taped some dynamite on a kangaroo, perhaps?
Well, it's a galignite to a rabbit. I saw it's a rabbit. Uh-huh. There might be a coyote in the West. There's another kangaroo story. There isn't an exploding kangaroo as far
as
I know.
If it spreads around that much mm-hmm. and people really believe it to be mm-hmm. true, then from a psychological point of view, one would have to say this story is serving some significant need in people. It's giving them some significant reassurance, some significant titillation. It's somehow rendering justice mm-hmm. symbolically. Anything that really lasts in the way of common belief, it seems to me, serves some deeper function. What function do you think that story?
Well, it shows the cruelty of the person justly punished, it seems to me.
So it's a moral tale.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, most of these are like fables, even if there isn't a specific proverb at the end, you know, don't count your chickens before they're hatched or something. There is certainly a lesson that's implied. And in fact, sometimes when people tell stories of this kind, they will add some commentary. You know, they'll tell a story about a thwarted attempt at abducting a child from a shopping center or a shopping mall restroom or something like that. And then they'll say, you know, I would never let my kids use those restrooms. I would stay right. I would never let them out of my sight in that place. So there are implied lessons and there are stated lessons and there are just demonstrations of supposedly how things are in the world when people tell them.
There are some stories in here about what happens when you're driving in a car and you stick your hand or your head out to enjoy the winds ruffling your hair.
Yeah.
Whether this is an animal or a child.
Yeah. Well, you know, people always say to the kids, you know, keep your hands inside the car. It's just going to get cut right off.
Right.
Keep those heads inside the car, kids.
And if you got enough warnings of that sort, yeah. inevitably a story is going to be invented which demonstrates the truth
yeah.
of that dire prediction.
That's true. But you notice that it isn't just a story that someone says, I heard about a kid who let his hand hang out the window.
What happened to my uncle's friend?
And it got cut off. No, there'll be more to it than that. I think my favorite version of this, and maybe you can psychoanalyze why I like this one.
Is it the sheet metal one?
That's my second favorite. But all right, you can tell your favorite. I'll tell mine. Mine is with the one where the dog has the head out the window, and the head is neatly cut off by something that goes by, and the person sitting there petting the dog doesn't notice it for several miles until finally the dog hasn't moved for a while. They look, and they're holding this headless dog. But the motorcycle one is great.
But you tell that one.
The motorcycle one is about a motorcyclist who's about to pass a big truck that has a load of sheet metal on it, and the load shifts a little bit just as he comes around, and a sharp-edged piece of this metal cuts his head right off, and there's a sort of convulsion in the body, and the hands give a little twist, which speeds up the cycle, and so the headless motorcyclist goes right past the truck, which then supposedly leads the truck driver in shock and horror to lose control and steer right into a crowd of people waiting for a bus or something like that.
Now, this must be related to Washington Irving's Ichabod Crane, the Headless Horseman.
The Headless Horseman. Well, related not in the sense that somebody said, let's update this story and tell it about trucks instead of horseback riding.
No, but the idea of a headless rider must have been set down, not necessarily by Washington Irving. It may have been around in folk material long before Irving wrote his stories.
I think it was. I think it was in German folklore, as a matter of fact. I think uh-huh. Irving read some European legend and then Americanized it. But the theme is in folklore more widely. Yeah, I agree with you. I didn't mean that, of course, that somebody had modified Irving's tale specifically, but the idea of the headless rider almost, an apparition or something like that, and then causing these series of disasters.
I have decided that I am responsible for one new tale that you've got in your book.
Gee. Well, then I'll have an answer for the question so many people asked. Have you ever discovered where? You don't mean that you originated the story.
No, I mean that I told you the story.
Oh, I see that you told it to me.
It was the story that I told you last time you were here. I asked you if you had ever heard it, and you said no, you hadn't, and now I find it in your book.
I think I'm in trouble.
I don't know what you say about the sources. You don't mention me, but you said you say you've received this story from two or three different sources.
Yeah, this is the blind date story. Is
exactly.
That the one? Is that the one?
Exactly.
Yeah. The kid's on his way to a blind date, and he stops at the drugstore to get some supplies, to buy some condoms, and he's kind of cocky and sure of himself, and he says to the pharmacist, "Hey, I'm really going to have a great time tonight. You know, give me a couple of packages or something like that. I'm really going to score tonight." And then when he gets to the home, the pharmacist turns out to be the father of the girl he's
That's
dating that night.
That is the story.
Yeah.
It was told in the circles in which I moved as a teenager in New York City. It was told as having happened to my brother's best friend or something of the sort.
Well, I must have just put it in my mental data bank, but some other people added to that.
I had heard it more than once. It's one of those things that's been around and around.
Here's what happens a lot of times. People will write to me and say, "I read your book, but you left out my favorite story." And then they'll send me a list of stories. And I cut up those letters and file them and tap them into my computer and so on.
By now, you are an international clearinghouse, I gather, for stuff like this. After your prior books, which were The Choking Doberman, The Vanishing Hitchhiker, you did a number of other books earlier about American folklore. But those last two.
Yeah, those are the urban legend books.
Really stirred up this interest in urban legends.
Yeah, I get a lot of mail, and I get a lot of inquiries from journalists who are trying to settle whether they should go out and bother to try to track down this story or not. They'll call up and ask me, print journalists usually, "Have you heard this one? It's going around town." And if I can tell them that that I've got several versions of it, it saves them some time.
Has this one happened before? Have you received record of it occurring in other cities? I'm sure it must have. Many years ago, perhaps 10 years ago, at my office at the University of Chicago, I got a call one day from a local newspaper asking me for commentary on an event which had transpired, or the story of an event that had transpired at Michael Reese Hospital here in Chicago just the day before. An infant had been born and was speaking in full and competent English and announced himself to be Jesus Christ come again.
I have not heard that.
What did I, as a social psychologist, the reporter asked, think about the rapid spread of this story? He didn't believe the story, but he knew that there were people running around town saying, this happened at Michael Reese a day or two ago.
Well, I suppose people want miracles to keep on happening.
But have you heard of
miraculous
births of a Christ child again?
I don't believe I have. I don't believe I have.
Because
how could I forget a thing like that?
Yeah.
I don't think
The time, I think there was an extended article done on the basis of research by some reporter in this very building at the Chicago Tribune, who did trace similar stories to other locations over the last year or two.
I'm not familiar with them, no.
What are you familiar with in the broad realm of stories of religious significance?
Well, one of the things that happens is that attitudes like anti-Semitism get reflected in rumor and legend, or get developed in rumor and legend. There are the markings on kosher food, for example. The K, the U in the circle, or the word parva. And sometimes people will have little stickers reproducing these symbols, which are really on the food, as you know, which really do mark the kosher food, and it'll say Jewish secret tax on food.
Yeah.
And they'll go around supermarkets sticking these on packages of things, and you'll get leaflets or newsletters or photocopied, very crudely written things, claiming that it costs the Gentiles a great amount of money in their extra food bills just to have this food specially tested and marked and prepared and packaged for the Jews. It's not exactly a legend, but it's certainly a nutty story.
Well, it's not a story.
It's a rumor.
It's an interpretation.
Yeah, it's an interpretation of the thing.
Of a particular event in the world.
And, of course, people look at packages of food and in their own homes that they bought and say, there is the marking, and that seems to give it some credence. You know, it must mean something, and it's like that Procter & Gamble trademark.
I was about to say, it's like that crazy thing that Procter & Gamble had a hard time fighting that down, didn't they?
I think they're still fighting it. I've lately seen some more of those photocopied broadsides going around. They'll show you the trademark, the man in the moon in the circle with the 13 stars. They'll copy this on these broadsides or on these sheets. And then they'll say, look, this is a satanic symbol. 13's a bad number. you can hold it up to the mirror and see the curlicues in the beard. That makes 666. That's the mark of the beast. You can even link the stars with lines that make them into three sixes. That is the arrangement of the stars. And another 666. And people will say, I heard that the president of Procter & Gamble was on some national television show admitting that they contribute to the Church of Satan, and this mark on their goods.
When probably he was on some national television show denouncing all of this as nonsense.
I don't believe that they ever have put anyone on TV to do it, because they can still then say no one from P&G has been on Donahue or 2020 or whatever the program is. I don't believe they have, but certainly they have never been on TV saying that it's a satanic symbol.
Didn't I read that they were giving up the symbol because of all of this campaign?
I think they're reducing its use on the products but keeping it as a corporate symbol. That's the way I understood it anyway, that you'll still find it in Cincinnati on the big office building and on their letterhead or something, but maybe not so much on the soap and toothpaste.
There are all sorts of rumors that run around about contamination. Indeed, you've got a section called Contamination Stories.
Yeah. Well, the sort of classic ones, which I've dealt with earlier, are things like the batter-fried rat, the mouse in the Coke, the finger in the pickle jar, cat parts in restaurant chop suey. It's often foreign food or fast food.
A famous person in this town who for a while was helping to run a magazine and decided that she would do the restaurant reviews for that magazine appeared on this program once and said, whether on the air or off, that she had got a batter-fried rat in a well-known fast food chain.
What did she do?
She vowed never to return to that fast food chain, at least, I guess.
Yeah, it seems...
But she told it as something which had happened to her.
It seems highly unlikely.
It does to me, too.
But one thing I could say, that is not the legend. The legend is not just that someone says, I got a batter-fried rat, period. The legend is... There's this couple, and they went to such and such a place, and it's usually named by either the street it's on or at least the chain. And they took the bucket of chicken to the drive-in movie or to a picnic, and they were eating it by fire. It's always dim light in front of the fireplace or something. And the girl says, gee, mine really tastes terrible. And the boyfriend says, well, I don't know. There's nothing wrong with mine. And they finally turn on the light, and they see a rat tail hanging out of the piece of chicken, and then they sue the company. In other words, there's a whole developed story that has kind of a logical conclusion.
It's one major category. I would call it the Yuki story.
The Yuki story?
Yuki. Yeah. A sudden source of disgust having to do with animals encroaching upon our lives, whether in our diet or otherwise.
Yeah, well, the Mexican pet is a yucky story, I suppose. There's even a yucky yucca story, you know. It was going around in London. Yeah, people were buying potted yucca plants and claiming, well, it wasn't the people that bought them, but people that knew people that knew people that supposedly bought them, that deadly tarantula spiders were infesting these plants. Sometimes they would have the plant in the house for a while and neglect to water it enough or something, and then supposedly, or it would be making some noise, and supposedly this big, awful, hairy spider came out. And there were stories, and there were specific to a particular chain of, I think it was Marks and Spencer, a department store.
Fine department store.
And so the London Times ran stories saying, we've looked into this. These plants are imported via, I think it was Belgium or Holland. They are carefully repotted and checked. There have been no reports of anyone getting a yucca plant with a spider in it. Please, folks, don't worry about it anymore. But that's yucky, too, I guess, if it happens to you.
The mothers of my acquaintance when I was a little boy growing up in Brooklyn used to be very concerned about snakes or bugs crawling out of patches of fruit that one might buy.
That was
sort of a common cautionary consideration that was often mentioned. And I think occasionally a story was offered in confirmation of that particular anxiety. Yeah. Some little boy three streets down had been bitten by a snake that came out of a bunch of bananas.
Mm-hmm. I suspect there's a lot less of that kind of story now that so many things are either shrink-wrapped, as they call it, in the plastic fruit, vegetables more than fruit, or, you know, supermarkets where we buy a lot of our produce are so clean and neat and organized, and they're always out there spraying things and so on, that there'd be less of it. But there is, of course, the kind of contamination story where the person is in the discount store trying on a sweater, feels a little pinprick, and thinks it's a tag or a pin or something, and doesn't buy that sweater. But later in the day, her arm starts to swell up, and the woman goes to the hospital, and they look at her and say, something has bitten you. It seems to be some sort of poisonous snake or insect or something. Where have you been today? And they get back to the store eventually, and tracing her movements during the day, and they find a nest of some cobras or vipers or some rare poisonous Japanese snake in these goods, which were imported always from usually a far eastern country. So you still have that idea of the contamination, but it has the themes in it of the discount store and the foreign goods and the thing that doesn't belong there at all.
A general anxiety about alien sources and alien material.
I think so.
Penetrates many of these stories.
Yeah, I think so. Now, sometimes it's very specific even to a group. For example, there'll be rumors really rampant about, say, Southeast Asian immigrants. If a community has a lot of immigrants from, say, Laos or Vietnam or something, you tend to start to get, somebody's heard this from somebody who heard it from somebody else, they're stealing our pets. Our cats and dogs are disappearing at an alarming rate, and these people are eating them. And people write letters to the editor. I quote one in the book from the Salt Lake Tribune, which then I answered. And they'll say, this happens all the time, or I've heard it over and over again. But then when the newspaper looks into it, they call the police, the Humane Society. They try to check back with pet owners. Is there anyone who has lost a pet? Is there anyone who has found pet remains in their garbage or something? They find no particular rash of missing pets and no proof that immigrants are eating
them. A classic story, which was known as the blood libel, was used. You mentioned anti-Semitic stories before.
Mm-hmm.
Was used against Jews in Europe for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
It goes way back to the tale of Isaac of Lincoln. Was that his name? That he made matzah. That a crucial ingredient was the blood of innocent little Christian boys.
This is the story that has its analog in the Prioress's tale, I think, in Chaucer's
tale. It's told in the Prioress's tale.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a ballad referring to it, mm-hmm. too. Little Sir Hugh is what it's called.
Quite so.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't that Sir Hugh of Lincoln?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
In the late 19th or early 20th century in Tsarist Russia, there was a famous trial of a man named Bayliss, I think Isaac Bayliss, a simple Jewish tailor or something of the sort, who was accused of having done the same. And it became a cause celeb by then the International Zionist Organization and mm-hmm. other such Jewish organizations which mm-hmm. were trying to defend against mm-hmm. the anti-Semitism that was prevalent in Eastern Europe and elsewhere in the world, so that it became a litigation upon which the world focused,
mm-hmm.
and thus a famous case. But it was based upon the Hugh of Lincoln story.
Sure. I think the form that it takes in American folklore is a racist story, is a story against blacks rather than against Jews, that a little boy was kidnapped by a gang of black youth, a little white boy, and they take him into a restroom or behind a building or something and castrate him, that they have to do this and prove they've done it to get into a gang or something like that. So whites will circulate this story as supposedly an example of what that bad gang is doing, you see.
Of course, one of the great modern urban legends, and you've told it before, it's in your earlier book, and it's a very interesting complex compound of anti-black orientation, and at the same time, it's anti-anti-black. The elevator story.
The elevator story.
Why don't you just tell?
Yeah, that has a little more palatable theme, and it's a nice surprise ending. And it has a new version that's going around, incidentally.
Has it?
Yeah, the older one that I wrote about a couple of years ago. Usually, three women. I've heard it. They're from Indianapolis or Cincinnati. Usually, a large city in the Midwest. And they go to New York City. They're middle-aged ladies. They've never been in New York, but they decide to go for vacation. And sometimes there are a set of warnings. The son of one of them will say, "Be real careful, Mom. You know, it's a jungle out there." Or the airline stewardess will say, "You have a good time, but you got to be careful in New York." Maybe the cab driver warns them too, or the travel agent. So they're kind of set up to be worried. And the first day, they're on the elevator going down to the lobby to go sightseeing or something, and the only person to get on the elevator with him is a very large black man with a dog and a leash. The door closes, and he says, "Sit." And these ladies just sit right down on the floor. And he looks at him in surprise and some humor and says, "Oh, I meant the dog." Sometimes he says, "Sit, lady," or "Hit the floor, lady." "I meant my dog," he says. And they get up in some confusion, and they sometimes, to make a little conversation, ask him if he would recommend a restaurant in the area. In that case, they find their bill has been paid, or he looks at the number in their key and their room bill has been paid and there's a note in the box, or they go to the restaurant and champagne is sent to their table with a note. In any case, supposedly it was Reggie Jackson.
Reggie Jackson was the one who was the hero of the story, or the central black man in the story, has changed over time, I guess.
Yeah, what's happened now is it's told as a story about women visiting Las Vegas. They win some money. One of them starts up in the elevator to go to her room mm-hmm. to leave some money in the mattress or wherever you hide your money. They're not a good idea, I think, but, you know, so as not to gamble it all away. And coming down the hall, still the elevator in the story, mm-hmm. but coming down the hall as she walks to her room is another black man with a dog and a leash who says, "Sit, lady," or "Hit the floor, lady," or "Get down, lady." "Get down, lady" is pretty good. And she sits down. It's Lionel Richie this time. Except it isn't, of course. This never happened either to Reggie Jackson or Lionel Richie.
But it spreads like wildfire. Here's an incredible thing that happened with Reggie Jackson or with Lionel Richie.
Yeah.
People believe it.
Yeah. These have been printed, too. They get in the supermarket
tabloids. That's the major route of diffusion, I suppose.
Well, I think it's a main one for celebrity stories and for stories with that kind of a twist. At least the printing in tabloids helps a good deal because a lot of people read those and get around very quickly.
I wonder how many times Reggie Jackson or Lionel Richie has had to deny the authenticity of that tale.
I've seen Reggie Jackson and his manager, his agent, and so on quoted many times in the press. Usually a sports editor will finally get him on the phone and say, what about that story with the dogs? And they will say, not that again. I haven't seen any denials from Lionel Richie.
You are truly a great storyteller because you're totally deflecting me from my duties. We are some 10 minutes late for some commercials. Let's take care of those, and then directly back to Jan Harald Brunvand, whose newest book is titled The Mexican Pet and is just published by Norton.
When you're thirsty and want something cool, refreshing, tasty, and natural, think of Flavor Fresh natural fruit juices. Flavor Fresh pure juices are made nature's way without preservatives or added sugar. You can see the quality because Flavor Fresh is packed in glass bottles. So for a natural taste sensation, try Flavor Fresh's apple juice. It's like drinking the taste of orchard fresh, juicy, ripe apples. Try Flavor Fresh's three other natural juices too: orange, grape, and grapefruit. You'll love them all, and you'll love the price, too. Compare Flavor Fresh to other nationally advertised juices. You'll see the difference isn't only the freshness. So go natural. Try them all. Why not try Flavor Fresh's new 16-ounce size container in the refrigerated juice section of your supermarket? If you don't find it, ask the manager to get it for you. The best of nature is waiting for you. The fresh, natural taste from Flavor Fresh. Flavor Fresh is available in Jewel and certified food stores and in Walgreens in the glass juice department. Ash Manor. It sounds grand, and it is. From the beauty of its three dining rooms recreated to their original early 20th century splendor, to the elegant creations of a kitchen that puts the personal touch into every dish they prepare, Ash Manor is a convenient stop before or after the Cub game or a theater date, with plenty of free parking available, too. Plan your private parties, even weddings, at the elegant home, and now you can have lunch or dinner outdoors in the balcony. Call 248-1600. Don't wait until the weekend to enjoy the elegance of Ash Manor, 1600 West Diversey. Head for the hills. Head for Dominic's and save on Hills Brothers Coffee. 3-pound cans of regular auto drip and electric perk coffee are just $7.99 each. You'll save on every spoonful of cool, refreshing Gold Crown ice cream. All your favorite flavors in 1.5-gallon containers are just $1.29 each. You can't top the savings this week on 12-pack soda. All varieties of Pepsi, Coke, 7-Up, RC, and Canfields in 12-ounce cans are just $2.99 each 12-pack. Stock up and save through Wednesday at Dominic's. Himmel Furs. Experience the difference of experience, and save as never before at Himmel's annual August fur sale, now 2201 West 95th, Chicago. From WGN Radio Chicago, this is Extension 720. Here once again is your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to Jan Harald Brunvand in just a moment. But first, let's talk to our listeners. I'm sure you agree with me, Jan. We'd love to get all sorts of additional legends from callers. And they can ask us, not only have you heard this story, but they can also check out, here's a funny tale that I was told. I thought it was true, but tell me, is it one that you've heard before? Is it one that's really in circulation, and have I just been on the receiving end after a long line of transmission? Wouldn't that be nice to get
into? That's always interesting, what kind of stories are brought to people's minds by these rather miscellaneous examples that we talk about.
So any stories you've got that you want to check out or just want to share because you think they represent the art and the very nature of the urban legend, do by all means give us a call. We won't be onto the phones instantly, rather at around 10 o'clock. But the number is, as ever, 591-7200. And if you don't mind waiting a bit and want to get online, you can give us a call right now, 591-7200. The number 312, the area code if you're calling long distance. The stories are, all of them, worth retelling, as well as many of them, of course, are quite provocative of further analysis or raise questions. I turn to one section, indeed to Chapter 5, which is titled simply Sex and Scandal. That's a dull subject. Let's talk about it.
Well, some of them are pretty simple. You know, it's a kind of one-liner. You know, green M&Ms make you horny, guys will say. And the only result of that, besides, I suppose, trying it, is things like fraternity guys have a dish of green M&Ms. They carefully pick all the green ones out and save them for special occasions, something of that sort.
What do you think the origin of that particular odd superstitious notion would be.
I am puzzled about that.
Red is the color of passion, not green.
Well, you know, my thought was red is a color of passion. I looked at the M&Ms, no red ones. Well, so much for that theory.
Uh-huh.
And green, fertility or something like that. I find it very, very puzzling. I have no particular theory on that. Maybe they're not the most common color. I think there are more brown ones, dark brown ones, and maybe tan ones than uh-huh. the other. But I don't know why that would be. And I suppose probably nobody believes it. I think it's probably more a gag. You would just have some different ones and offer some to your girlfriend and say, hey, have a green one or something like that.
And you'd know the private joke.
Yeah, you would.
Are you up to telling the story of the ski accident?
Oh, I love the ski accident. Yeah, I'm a skier. Are you a skier?
I've tried it.
Yeah.
Do rather poorly at it.
Well, I like it. I found it in a newspaper in Atlanta, for example. It was said to be the experience of an airline hostess taking a vacation in the Far West. I heard it in the Far West where I live, said to be the experience of, I think it was a Mexican woman skiing at Park City, a wealthy family from Mexico coming up and skiing at this posh resort and so on. I heard it on the phone from a guy from Canada who said he wasn't sure where she was skiing, but it was somebody from Saskatchewan or something coming down to the States where it was a little warmer to go skiing. It's always a woman. She's always a little unsure of herself as a skier. She decides to take the plunge, so to speak, ride to the top of the lift and ski the whole run this time. She gets up to the top of the mountain, and she needs to go to the bathroom. And there's no lodge up there. It happens at that particular lift. And she's not so sure she even wants to take her skis off and try to get them on again. So she decides she'll just ski down a ways, get over behind some pine trees, and pull her pants down and take care of the need. But just as she gets set and pulls her pants down, she slips and slides down into a tree or something, has an accident, is brought into the first aid room. Just as they're treating her, they bring in another stretcher, and this is a ski patrolman or perhaps an instructor. And she's surprised, at least takes her mind off her problems, and says, how could you have an accident? How could this happen? You're a much more experienced skier than I am, of course. And he says, well, I had a day off today, but I was just skiing, you know, enjoying myself, skiing around, and suddenly this woman came flying by backwards with her pants down. I laughed so hard I ran into a tree. How about you? And she says, I just fell down. I found that in Sweden. I actually found that story.
They do a lot of skiing there. That was,
yeah, I found it. I was talking to a Swedish folklorist at a meeting, and and we happened to get on the subject of skiing, and I said, how about this story? And he said, you mean our famous Swedish nude skier story? And I said, don't tell me. And, of course, I meant, do tell me. And he sent me a newspaper clipping, which I reproduce in the book, which has a little drawing of this skier with her pants down, the other guy running into a tree. So the story is known in Sweden as well as the United States, perhaps more widely for all I know.
I suppose we get all sorts of stories from abroad and then adapt them and shape them to the American scene.
Yeah, it's not always possible to tell which way they go. For example, a story that is in the book only in the sense that I've written in the rear flyleaf here as I hear new stories, not in your copy, in my copy. I wrote it.
Oh, yes?
I wrote it in the back here. I've heard this in the United States, and I thought it sounded fishy. I thought it sounded like a legend, in other words. And recently I was sent a version from England. The American version of it is this. A couple have been living together, but they have a big argument, and the man says, let's break up, and I'm going on a trip, and I just wish you'd pack all your stuff and get out of the apartment, you know. And it's not a nice parting, but so much for that. He comes back from the trip, and the woman is gone, and her belongings are gone, and he hears something in the next room, and he goes in, and the phone's off the hook, and he picks up the phone, and some strange language is being spoken. Turns out to be Japanese. She's dialed up Tokyo Time and Weather Service and left the phone off the hook as her last parting shot to him. So the English version, she dials up what was called the speaking clock. Have you heard that expression? The version
that
was sent to me, they said she dialed up the New York City speaking clock. And it also added the detail that she was a vegetarian and she was looking for some revenge. She had a lot of mustard seed and watercress seed. I guess she raised her own salad. She sprinkled it around the apartment and all the upholstery and the rugs and bed and everything, and then watered down the whole place. So he came back to find a jungle of these things growing up and the phone off the hook, with time and temperature in New York City running up his phone bill astronomically.
There must be thousands of recorded folk tales all the way from near antiquity and on to the present moment and into the urban setting concerning the tragedies of love and hauntings by old lovers and love gone awry and somehow reverberating down through the ages in strange events.
Mm-hmm.
Ghost stories relating to lost lovers.
Ghost stories. I don't really do ghost stories, with one exception.
The Vanishing Hitchhiker.
The Vanishing Hitchhiker, which is...
Which you've got 1,000 versions of.
Oh,
by now,
yes, that is the one exception to my focus on modern legends. It's the one that's supernatural. It isn't exactly a lost lover returning, but it's certainly a beautiful young woman returning.
You've got a new variant of it in this book, the one set in Romania.
Yeah, that's really odd, I think. And it's odd in two ways. It's a strange story, and it's curious that I would happen to find it. I happened to be in Romania, and there was a kind of literary controversy. Two different popular novels, a couple of years apart, had used the same little episode, and there was a controversy in letters to the editor in a literary paper there. And
somebody was about to sue somebody else for plagiarism.
Yeah, and then what turned out, they both had heard it as a story, sure. And somebody else wrote and said, I've heard it too. And
tell
so
the
on.
Romanian version. It's a wonderfully haunting story.
Yeah, let me just recap quickly. The American version, the driver picks up a hitchhiker who disappears from the car and turns out to be a ghost trying to hitchhike home. Of course, there are lots of details. It's, in fact, Resurrection Mary of the Chicago area. You know, there is a Chicago specific version of that.
Well, you write about her in this book, and I think I've read about stories of Resurrection Mary in the local press at times.
I have some clippings people have sent me. Well, the Romanian one, the man is given a ride home by two women who are driving back to Bucharest. He needs a ride. His car is stalled or something. And they invite him to come to their apartment. And he goes up to their apartment and has a cup of tea, and they strike up a friendship, and they're chatting, and he goes into the bathroom to wash his hands. He takes his watch off and puts it on the shelf under the mirror, and forgets it there. And the evening goes by delightfully. In fact, into the morning, he loses track of time. It was late when they got there anyway. He just goes on to work, but he discovers his watch is missing. And when the story is told, they even mention the kind of watch. They'll say the glass shelf under the mirror. And so many Romanian apartments have this glass shelf under the mirror. So he goes back to get his watch and finds the apartment door closed and sealed, indeed sealed with little strings and wax by some authority. He asks, knocks on a neighboring apartment door and said, "What's going on?" They say the women that lived there died in a tragic automobile accident, and the door is sealed because there is some dispute over their property, and the legal authorities have sealed it until the will is taken care of, and so on. He says, "This can't be. I was there last night." And he seeks the authorities' help. They open the – are you ready for this? They open the apartment. They go in. He goes straight to the bathroom, and there is his watch on the shelf under the mirror. It reminds me very much of the last scene in The American Vanishing Hitchhiker.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to the cemetery and to her grave, and there is the sweater that the ghost borrowed draped over the tombstone. There's that object in the story that supposedly proves
one American variant has this happening every anniversary of the girl's death, and she's been dead for 13 years.
Yeah. That one was made into a... bluegrass song called Bringing Mary Home.
And you reproduce it.
Yeah, I
in the
give
book.
A verse of it. People kept saying, wasn't there a song? It turned out there were two songs at least. There was one by a singer named Dickie Lee that was popular. It was recorded in 1965 called Laurie or Strange Things Happen. And I give the whole lyrics of that after I finally tracked down a record of that and listened to it enough times to get the words. The other was called Bringing Mary Home, and a number of bluegrass groups recorded it, and they specifically said it's been 13 years ago tonight that they've been bringing Mary home or something like that. So on the anniversary of her death, which was her birthday or perhaps the prom night or something, she's trying to hitchhike home endlessly, making this trip and never quite making it.
There are loads of stories. You've got some of them here. I'm sure that it would... work as the topic for a major study and a whole book or a set of books that arise in wartime. And I would guess there are certain strange tales of coincidence or of magical events or of odd happenings which have been popping up in the stories of soldiers all the way from Caesar's legions in Gaul to World War II or to the Korean War.
Yeah, that certainly suggests a fertile area for collecting. I don't know if I want to rejoin the Army. I sort of paid my dues there. But certainly talking to military people, if I could extend that a little, I think people in the military, in prison, in certain kinds of work, hard labor and work where you are isolated for a long time or where you travel a long way to the job, where a lot of the job is highly tightly organized. When you have a break, you tell stories. The war thing, of course, wartime is a period of upset, and rumors are rife, and sometimes they're simple things like the enemy is attacking or they have been seen in some place, and sometimes they are stories that show the kind of dark side or sometimes the patriotic side of the folks at home. One of these stories that I have in the book, I call the War Profiteer, and I kept getting it from people. People would write to me and say, I remember this from the war years. I didn't, but then I was pretty young then, I guess. But I didn't remember. But people wrote to me and said, I remember this. Some people are on the bus, and one woman says to another, well, this is supposedly the early years of the Second World War. The war has been good for me and my husband. He's in the munitions business, and he's just making lots of money, and we're expanding the company, and I hope it lasts for a long time. The other woman says, same for me. We make parachutes or bomb sites or something, and our company is just doing – I keep wondering why they're on the bus, you know. Why don't they have extra gas coupons? Well, a woman gets up from across the aisle on the bus and slaps this other woman across the face and says, that's for my son who died in Pearl Harbor, and slaps the other one and says, that's for my nephew who's a prisoner in the Philippines. And, of course, the other women get off the bus. A reader of this book already, the book has only been out a month now, just about a month. He's an historian. He said, I'm doing some work on history of the early war years. I just found that story, not such an obscure source, 1942 issue of Time magazine. And I ran right to the library. It was easy to remember the date. It was March 23rd. It's my birthday, of all things. And I ran right to the library, put it on the microfilm reader, the roll of film.
Found it there.
And there it was. It was a section called U.S. at War, little bits of news from here and there. And this said something to the effect, everybody's been telling this story in the past week. Nobody seems to know who it happened to. Mm-hmm. And they mentioned two places in New York and one in Texas where their reporters had heard the story. And I think they came very close to saying it's always a friend of a friend of someone's friend or something like that. So, you know, there was a news magazine, in effect, collecting a bit of folklore, though carefully hedging it by saying the stories around, we don't know quite where it came from.